Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books Podcast. My name is Ikir Englander, and today I have the gift to host Adam Brown and to discuss his book, Judging Privileges, Holocaust Ethics, Representation and the Gray Zone. Before we start the dialogue, a few words about the importance of my book. As years pass, more and more Holocaust survivors are passing from our lives, and we are losing our life witness, those who experience the events of the war. In other words, we are the first generation of memory. As a Jewish leader and as a scholar, I constantly dealing with questions as what are the areas of the Holocaust that the survivors choose or mentally could not touch in depth. These places that we, third generation of memory, should put the spotlight on. One of these subjects are those Jews who were the communication link between the Nazis and the Jewish community. These Jews are the subject of this book. But the book touches also the question of how we will remember the Holocaust in general. Many of the young generation meet the Holocaust for the first time, not by listening to a survivor or reading the survivor's words, but by watching movies and by digital media. In 2019, Eva's story was published in the Instagram, a series of short videos that illustrate Eva Heyman's story in the style that characterizes the media, under the title Eva Stories. The videos went viral and attracted worldwide interest. It is such a gift to speak and learn with Dr. Adam Brown, who is a senior lecturer in media studies in Deakin University in Australia. Welcome, Adam. Can you share with us what have made you to write this unique book?
Thank you very much for having me on the podcast. The question of where this book came from, what brought me to write it, goes back a little bit before I guess I even knew it was a book. I was doing a PhD on the Holocaust, but that arose from me several years earlier than that, discovering a movie back in 2001 through a roommate when I was a first-year university student. It was a Jewish film festival in the city of Melbourne, and my friend told me about, well, he just showed me the program, and it had this film called The Gray Zone, which was Tim Blake Nelson's film that I actually ended up writing on in the last chapter of the book. And I didn't really know anything about it. I was aware of the Holocaust because I was about to study it the year after in my history major. But I went along. I actually got the train to the city, and it was a one-hour train ride. And I actually still remember I took along Primo Levi's book, The Drowned and the Saved, and I read the chapter on the gray zone on the train on the way to seeing the film. And the gray zone chapter obviously informs the book quite heavily and is really the reason it exists. And then the film became a nice bookend for it. So it was kind of a really serendipitous moment where just by chance I heard about a film and it really altered the direction of my life. I went on to study a history major and a literature major side by side. And I did an honours degree, which The Grey Zone played a key part, one of three films I looked at. And then the PhD really grappled this issue that comes out of the gray zone of moral ambiguity, moral compromise, ethical dilemmas of victims. And I still hadn't really articulated, especially in my honors year, what that exact dilemma was. But eventually, sometime into the PhD, I really began to categorize or conceptualize what I was looking at as so-called privileged Jews. And I was reading and watching a lot more media and different stories of it. And that's where the book eventually came from. I was asked at many conferences during the PhD why I was studying the Holocaust, especially when I was doing this topic. And usually the questions that began were not so much why this topic, but am I Jewish or am I German? And when the answers to both of those questions were no, people were understandably, perhaps, somewhat confused. And in the end, what's really struck me about this topic of the ethical dilemmas of victims, but also the Holocaust in general, is its universal applicability and what it tells us about it, humanity. And that's what this, where this topic really jumped at me and why the book came to be, because that question of what it means to be human, while a very extreme context and environment, the Holocaust obviously still continues to give us a lot of insight, not necessarily concrete answers, but a lot of insight into the same kinds of things that Primo Levi himself was grappling with years after surviving the camps. So that's really where the Holocaust came to intersect with my life. And I actually ended up being a volunteer for many years at the Jewish Holocaust Center in Melbourne, and became very close friends with a number of survivors. And I might come back and reflect on their reception and their engagement with this issue as I was making my way through the PhD, holding film screenings, public film screenings for a general audience at the center every month for 4 years. And so my journey through this topic was also being informed by the many people that I was working with side by side at the center for some years. And that was a really powerful, quite a confronting thing, obviously, as well. And I guess the best peer reviewers for your work are not necessarily at academic conferences when you're volunteering at a Jewish Holocaust museum. But that was really the kinds of the milestones to where I was coming from. All the things from watching cinema. I mean, I saw Schindler's List in the 90s, and that probably sparked my interest in the Holocaust as well. But ironically, both in my honours and PhD thesis and then travelling through into the book, I sharply criticised a lot of what happened in Schindler's List. But at the same time, that brought me into this area as well. So Holocaust literature, Holocaust history and Holocaust film kind of all converged in my story, because I was a Bachelor of Arts student majoring in literature and history, and I gained a strong interest in Holocaust film through both of those areas. And that's sort of all these intersections just sort of fell into place, I guess. And that's where this book came to be from.
Thank you, Adam. I really, it's so interesting that you came to learn more deeply about the Holocaust by a movie. And I think that now we are in a very, very interesting time in history where the Holocaust survivors, naturally, they're going to be less and less with us. And then coming generation are going to learn everything about the Holocaust from the media, from movies. And this is where the importance of your book. So if I go deep, I want to go to the term. Can you share with us a little bit more about the term privileges? What's the source of this term? Is during the Holocaust already people call them privileges? Or when it starts, when people or scholars or survivors start speaking about this term? And also, since a lot of your book is about the question, should we judge the privileges or not? And my question is, don't we judge them just by calling them in this term?
Mm. Yeah, no, it's a great question. And it does have a bit of a history as well throughout the trajectory of where this book came from and where it ended up being. I still recall when I began writing this book that my first idea of how to conceptualize, categorize this group of victims, and I suppose before I talk about the term, I should say that the so-called privileged Jews are a category that has been formed in part by me, but really talked about in lots of different avenues. Even at the time, the different languages involved mean that the term privileged itself might have different nuances in terms of what the, you know, protects you and the different terms that were being used at the time. But the category of prisoners who were forced to cooperate, and even the term cooperation has been debated, and obviously it's better than collaboration, but even some historians have said that cooperation doesn't really match up either. This term encapsulates so-called privileged prisoners in the camps and the ghettos from the Jewish councils, the Judenrat or the Ordnungsdienst, the Jewish police in the ghettos, through to the Kapos, the Sonderkommandos or special squads forced to work in the crematoria, different, you know, multi-layered hierarchy, different people, different victims within the multi-level hierarchy that the Nazis created. So it's a kind of a nebulous category in itself, but it's been made clear because of the judgments that have preceded my looking at this subject. But you make a really good point. The term itself, calling the group of prisoners privileged, does seem to layer on judgment. And there's a couple of things that come to mind with this. Initially, when I was writing the book or writing the PhD, the first category that, and I don't know how much of the draft material this actually kind of, you know, went into it, how many months I was using this, but my first use of the term was compromised Jews. Now, that was also in inverted commas, and my use of the term privilege has always got quote marks around it. But compromised Jews, that's where I began, even though I was trying to investigate, interrogate, unpack the idea of judgment. I was unable to escape any kind of subjective or loaded terminology. So privileged Jews came about in part because it was better than that, in part because it did have some connection with a lot of the ways in which these prisoners had been talked about over time, both shortly after and long after the events, but also because there was a way that I needed to explicitly and in a kind of a meta textual way draw attention to the fact that this was a provocative way of categorizing prisoners, because in a sense, you can use the term privileged victims and so on, but these prisoners who held positions did have different titles, and the judgments have varied among different people and different media on different groups of these victims within this broad umbrella. But what I ended up doing in the book was to start the entire book with what I called a personal note. And I tried to get as meta as I could there. It was just over, this was only in the PhD, and then I layered it into the first introductory chapter. I ended up having in my PhD a personal note on judgment and privileged Jews. And it was really unpacking this idea of using inverted commas, and that makes its way into the book, but not as kind of a prefacing comment in the same way. There's always a limitation to that, but I felt very strongly that using the inverted commas would at least flag in an aesthetic way, as much as a substantive way, that it was at least being used ironically. And what was interesting to share something that is obviously not in the book, during the process of publication, the copy editor had removed every single use of quote marks around the word privileged after my first use of it. And I ended up having to have a collegial but nonetheless a lengthy kind of conversation / debate just to keep the quote marks, because that was the issue. It was more so the awkwardness or the jarring fact that I was using quote marks around privileged all the time and not the fact that I was using the term. On the other hand, I will be completely transparent and say one of my friends, a child survivor of the Holocaust, who was at the launch of this book, who continues to volunteer at the Jewish Holocaust Center, he actually said to me that the subject matter, not so much the title, the use of that phrase, but the subject matter, which includes the use of the phrase and the focus on this group of victims, he said that he would have a copy of the book, but he wouldn't be able to open it for now because it was just too painful. And he was worried about the title in some ways as having counterproductive kind of effects. So it has been a provocative one, but I think after even the Holocaust survivors who I worked with, after I gave presentations there, after I spoke about this at conferences, and this question of calling a group of victims privileged did come up quite often, I think that people started to get what I was doing with it. So I was interrogating judgment and representation. That doesn't mean I'm objective. And the fact that I'm not Jewish, not German coming into this doesn't mean I'm any more neutral than anyone else. But it basically, I just try to flag in the most self-reflexive ways that I can, and I do this a few times in the book, that I myself could not help but sympathize with certain of the so-called privileged prisoners, such as the Sonderkommandos, particularly since my engagement with the films with them, in contrast, say, to my perception of Rumkowski through the various representations I engage with. So I'm not free of judgment myself, but I think one of the main things that I took from the experience of studying this group, but also tried to communicate within the book, is that as long as we're aware of that judgment, the paucity of language is something that I write about early on in the book. The paucity of language is such that there are no words that are not laden with judgment. There is no way to actually talk about these things without passing judgment, potentially at least being perceived as doing that. And Primo Levi himself really gestured to that when he was writing about the gray zone. You know, the gray zone is needed, but people simplify things. We need to make sense of the world by simplifying it. And I don't remember his exact words, but basically he says that the world would be an uncontrollable, chaotic mess if we don't simplify it. And one of the key ways we do that is through language. So the best that I could do was at least to explain where I was coming from, use quote marks all through the book, no matter how hard I had to fight for it, and be as reflexive in my own subjectivity. And, you know, depending on one's perspective on the analysis, I tried not to judge the victims I was writing about. There was that issue of passing judgment on, you know, which is what academics essentially do, on certain representations and creators of those. So, right. Yeah, it's quite a complex one, and hopefully that helps answer it.
Yes, for sure. For sure. Thank you, Adam. So the first chapter, the first part of the book focuses on the gray zone and the privileges in the literature and thoughts of Primo Levi. And I want to quote Primo Levi, very important, I mean, very interesting quotation that you bring in the book. And he said like that: "Many things were then said and done among us, but of this it is better that there remain no memory." And in a generation, or when we try so much to remember the Holocaust, and we have a wish that we will capture it and we will bring it to the next generation and for the next generation as a whole narrative, comes such a sentence by Primo Levi. And he said, "Some things needs to be forgotten." And I wonder what we can learn from that, and what we can learn from that about judging the privileges. Can you elaborate for us?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I'll come back to Levy, but one of my other experiences during the writing of this book, it was probably during my PhD, was when I was at the Sydney Jewish Museum, and I was talking, I believe, to a child of Holocaust survivors there who worked there as a guide in the museum. And we got talking, and as usually happens, my theme of my research came up in conversation. And I remember that person saying, they don't talk about this to visitors to the museum. This is a child of survivors because it's too complicated, or it's just too early. I've heard this quite a bit as well, 50 plus years after, you know, when I started to research, more than 50 plus years after the events, that it was too early to discuss these things. And I'd heard that among people I was working with in Melbourne as well. And that's a really provocative idea. When is it not too early came into my mind. And in a sense, what Levy is suggesting there, and there's been some interesting interpretations of what he was actually referring to there, because I believe that line might be one of the, there's a lot of psychologically based biographies on Levy, and I believe that might be interpreted as also making reference to a murder that may have happened in the trains on the way to Auschwitz, of someone who was perceived to be a collaborator. I can't remember entirely that, but there are these things that Levy was grappling with quite often, and what to omit, what to forget, the power of forgetting. And some things, you know, you would argue memory is important, and in certain contexts, some form of forgetting is necessary as well, is a provocative one when we come to the Holocaust. Collectively and individually, that issue of what can be not talked about. The problem with the way that I perceive this area of so-called privileged Jews is that there had been, and there's, you know, probably far less so now. There certainly was a taboo at ground level on talking about this in certain contexts. And so I don't think Primo Levi was on his own in that regard. We've seen, especially in cinema, that certainly changed, and that may or may not be a mostly productive thing, given that, you know, we're in the age of the anti-heroic, and the moral ambiguity is the flavor of the decade and so on in cinema. So there's some interesting cultural dynamics at work there as well. But this has certainly been a more of a time where these issues that Levy may have been making reference to, it's impossible to know exactly what he was referring to. These issues have come to the fore now. So even in the kind of chronology of Levy's own writings, there is a lot of evidence of him revising his descriptions of certain victims in the camps, even in different versions, different editions of his first memoir, If This Is a Man. So there's an interesting kind of subjectivity to Levy himself. And that first substantive chapter, where I actually look at the writing of Levy, the evolution of his ideas on the grey zone, and I look at that throughout his entire all the literature that he put together. The entire book could have been about Levy, and to be honest, in the early stages of writing it, almost was. But so many people have written on Levy, I decided to do something slightly different. There's so many different changes in trajectory in Levy's thinking, and it's always impossible to know exactly how much he was preoccupied with this. But from his writing, even before he was using the term the grey zone, shortly after the war, he was thinking about this issue. And so it took some years before he himself could conceptualize this area that he ended up calling the grey zone. And he used other phrases which can be loosely translated as grey zoners and so on, which I go into in the book. So even he was struggling with the language. Victim behavior, there's a lot in the survivor literature, lots of memoirs that talk about and make reference to things that are probably not talked about in as much detail. But that's really the crux of what we also learn about humanity as well, and that this clear-cut binary opposition of good and evil doesn't always and seldom really sheds light on human experience to the extent that we might like it to. So that's probably a long-winded answer to try and get to something there around what Levy was saying. But I think that that's so crucial to the issue that even Levy was struggling to write about this. And while he argued, as I kind of take him as the launching pad of my book, that we should not pass moral judgment on these victims and their behavior, his own writings, even in the chapter on the gray zone, cannot escape from passing judgment. And that's what I talk about as the paradox of judgment, the inappropriateness of it, but simultaneously the inescapability of it as well. And that's all comes down to that paucity of language that I talked about before. Even with such an articulate, philosophical, amazing writer as Levy, who, I mean, half my book could have been Levy quotes because you love his writing that much. So even he struggled years later, decades later, when he was trying not to judge these victims who he understood, certainly better than I ever can, what kind of pressures they faced.
So thank you. So Adam, in other words, by not writing about something, by keeping them in silence, there is also silence. There is also judgment about the silence, which bring a whole new, question that probably will never be answered about all the materials that we don't have about the Holocaust because the survivors decided to not to share, right? And not to share the trauma. And this is something that fascinated me as a second generation and as a third generation of the Holocaust. In Israel, the first time that, I mean, again, we knew about, or I knew about the kapos, we knew that they were there, the privileges, but the focus was never about them. The first time that I met them was actually in literature by, there is an Israeli writer, and her name is Savion Librecht. And in one of her short stories, it's called Ruchale Mitchatenet, that Ruchale, she get married. And this Ruchale, who is a very Yiddish name, right? I mean, she is the only daughter for a father who never spoke about the Holocaust, but he was there. And then one day she come home and she has incredible relationship with her father. And she come home and she said, Abba, father, I'm going to get married. And he's so excited and happy, and he's looking forward to meet the groom. And then when she introduced him, her future husband, he immediately faints. And then she learned that this boy that she's going to get married with, he is a child of the couple that torture her father. And he just sees the couple every time when he need to deal with his future son-in-law. And it's fascinating when we share about the privileges in literature, what we choose to share.
It's interesting, as you say, by not speaking about them, there is judgment. And I think that really, if I will go back to my first experience, without knowing it was an experience of a representation of a so-called privileged prisoner, it would have been probably in Steven Spielberg's Schindler's List, which I go on to write in the book, in the final chapter on feature film, that because Marcel Goldberg, being the main kind of privileged Jew figure in the film, is not represented as having any form of ethical dilemmas, or only extremely briefly, to the point within a three-hour film you would never notice it. Because of that, he's essentially one, demonized, two, infantilized, and three, marginalized. And therefore, while you're avoiding that issue, but also making as kind of an almost an extra or a side character enough of an issue, you are doing a huge disservice to a great many people suffering and the complexity of their experience. Now, the fascinating thing about Marcel Goldberg was that he was actually a very conflicted figure, a very controversial figure, who a lot of survivors have praised for saving their lives and others have condemned for, you know, not accepting money in return for helping people or not helping people at all. But after the war, he went on to run or own a factory of some kind and in a sense became an almost Schindler figure after the war. And this sort of, you know, broader story was what I located in some of my research. He, after he was, after he passed away, he was disinterred, I believe, and moved to a part of the cemetery on the, basically on the demands of other survivors, which was for criminals and prostitutes or something. And so there was a really interesting kind of complexity to a story that was elided in the movie. It was left out completely. It's in there a little bit more in Thomas Keneally's book from which, bringing up literature, the book from which Schindler's List originated, but without really going into the survivor story and, you know, looking at that story that's of a story but not really told, there's some really interesting questions there. And I think also what I started the book with and really pointing to what you're saying about the fact that we can never get a lot of the stories either because they chose not to tell them or they couldn't for one reason or another. And that's also a lot of what preoccupied Levy. Most of privileged prisoners did die. They were certainly not exceptions to the rule of the Nazis that all Jews were to be killed. They may have been able to prolong their lives, but they weren't necessarily able to save them, certainly not directly. And I think that's a really important distinction that I try to use in the language of the book. But the Sonderkommando who were forced to work in Auschwitz-Birkenau, all Jewish men, or predominantly as a few non-Jewish men, some accounts have, but Jewish men who were forced to, for an average or a maximum of roughly 3 months, to do the most horrific, indescribable work. Many of those men wrote manuscripts and buried them. And I think we only have roughly half a dozen that were discovered and kept. Now, a lot of those manuscripts are only half coherent because a lot of the words have faded. Most of the manuscripts have been lost because of Poles who came into the camp and were looking for, in the anti-Semitic way, looking for the gold fillings, looking for gold in among the ashes of the crematoria. So, you know, this kind of, these small amount of stories of the Sonderkommando that we can get a hold of, and even within that, I quote the Polish Jew Zalman Lewenthal. He writes about being ashamed of one another, and we dared not look one another in the face. I admit that I too, and this is full of ellipses and we don't know exactly what he was writing, it appeared that my actions too were, the truth is that one wants to live at any cost. One wants to live because one lives, because the whole world lives. He, and at other times, he and other writers within the Sonderkommando were immensely critical of themselves through their guilt of what they were doing, but also of each other. There was a lot of distinctions drawn between different crematorium workers. Even in that testimony coming from literally the bowels of the crematoria, we have judgment. We have disrupted language. We've got language that has every third word or more is now indecipherable. But we've still got judgment. We've still got some kind of meaning, but we've also got an impossibility of avoiding the judgment that we know we shouldn't be passing. But even the people there couldn't escape it. So that's kind of the most wonderful and tragic metaphor for me, is that the people who were doing that work were also starting the representation of so-called privileged Jews and begging that question of, you know, what would you have done, which I might come back to later.
So, yes. So I want to, you mentioned the questions about guilt and about surviving. And I want to quote from page 55, where you, when you quote from Levy, a very complicated sentence that I wonder how we should read it. So Levy said, the worst survived, the selfish, the violent. the collaborators of the gray zone. Their war survived, that is, the fittest. The best all died. Now, when Levy, what Levy want to teach us and how it's paint the whole group of people who survived in general?
There's been a lot written on what Levy was getting at with his phrase, the distinction between the so-called drowned and the saved. And on a more literal sense, and in part, it appears what Levy is talking about is the drowned and the saved, those who survived and those who were the saved, and those who did not were drowned. And there is a seeming connection, which is, interestingly enough, it's very, shortly after his longer reflection on survivor guilt, where we essentially see him connect the drowned, those who died being the best of us, as the more moral, the more righteous, the more, less prone to compromise, perhaps, and the saved being, as he says, the selfish, those who were not the fittest in a spiritual or moral sense. And Levy's own writings do complicate that. He feels guilt by the very fact that he obtained some shelter and indoor work towards the end of his own incarceration, as due to his chemist background, he probably wouldn't classify himself in the same category or as the so-called collaborators of the gray zones. But that's interesting in itself, that there's still those distinctions drawn that he can't escape. So what he means by that is, in one sense, as with all things, we have to read it critically and I think sympathetically, because Levy is also racked and given his history of depression and so on, he's racked by survivor guilt and other things. So this is informed by a lot of things. This key distinction of the book, The Drowned and the Saved, has certainly been hugely influential. But I think there is still that, even within his book itself, there is still a murkiness as to whether or not it's only a survival or those who perished and those who survived. I don't think the distinction matches up all that well, given that what else he says around that. So he's exploring again the potentialities of language and their, more so their limitations. Without going into a lot of things that admittedly other people have said about this distinction of the drowned and the saved, that's sort of at least some insight into what I was thinking with it. He does, play with these ideas in If This Is a Man as well. Right from the beginning, he was talking about, the moral compromise, and there's an amazing chapter where he seems to create a bit of a hierarchy through vignettes. And I don't know if you're familiar with it, but there's Paul Steinberg, who is the survivor, a French-Jewish survivor called Henri in Levy's book, his first memoir, If This Is a Man. Actually wrote a response to Levy in his own memoir, which was called Speak You Also, A Survivor's Reckoning. And I briefly talk about that in this book, but it's soul-shattering to hear a survivor so remorseful, so guilty that Levy had perceived him as one of the saved who was not the fittest in a moral sense. This teenager, essentially, who'd been through the camps, who'd obtained some kind of privilege but suffered immensely, read Levy's memoir, and Levy died before he himself could ever talk to him. Levy wrote in his memoir that, "I would very much like to know what happened to him, but I do not want to meet him again." And that's, for a canonical Holocaust author, that's what was written about Paul Steinberg, who then wrote his memoir, a very moving memoir, which I highly recommend, responding to Levy, saying, "I can't answer everything, but here's a bit more context." It's not an excuse. He's still blaming and judging himself. But you see this conflict throughout, these intricate connections between survivor stories, published and otherwise. And it's been an amazing privilege, to use the term in a drastically different way, for me to be able to engage with these in the amateur way that I can, because, you know, this is really does highlight some amazing things about what it means to be human, what it means to understand our experience, and what it means to try to make sense of the world and our place within it.
Thank you, Adam. So I would love to shift from the place of Primo Levi and literature to history. And in the chapter about Raoul Hilberg, you show us the amount of collaboration or working with, like, the question of how much the Nazis could do their plans without using the privileged Jews. But one thing that stuck with me in this chapter, and I would love if you can help us to understand it better, is the question of how much or how we should understand the reasons of the Judenrat to work together with the Nazis, and the question of how should we judge the actions as they are, or should we try to understand the reasons why they did as they did as historians? And in one of the pages in this chapter, you bring the question, I think in the name of Hilberg, but I apologize if I quote from the wrong one, about the question of what would happen if the Russians would come a few months before to that specific ghetto, because the ghetto survived until almost the end of the war, but the Russians didn't arrive. And if they would arrive, so the collaborators or the Judenrat we will not judge them, or the community or the historians will not be judged as collaborators, but as heroes. So we see a very, very fine line between the two. And, you know, as someone who works with Jewish theology, I think about one of the main leaders in the times of the destruction of the Second Temple. And his name was Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. And in the Jewish memory, in the Talmud, they share that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai met with the Roman emperor, and the Roman emperor asked him, "What do you wish and I will give you as a gift?" And he didn't choose to tell him, "Go away from Jerusalem," but he asked him for three other things. And in the last day of his life, when his students are around his bed, they ask him, "Rabbi, what do you see?" And he says, "I see two directions which are open to me, one to heaven and one to hell, and I don't know in which one I'm going to be taken." And there is something about this sentence, which is very important in Jewish theology, about Jewish leadership in time of crisis, that is walking with me. So I would love if you can help us to understand it better.
Well, I hope that I'll be able to. I guess the one thing, this was the chapter on history, historical writing of Raoul Hilberg, was probably the latest and the last addition into the study in the end. I didn't know it was going to be there until I think it was recommended by my supervisor at the time that I think about this, just because I was broaching so many different platforms and different media. But it was a really nice kind of segue, but also a way to look in depth at the issue from Primo Levi's writing through to the documentary film by Claude Lanzmann, Shoah, which I looked at in the subsequent chapter, given that Hilberg was in there. So Hilberg as a figure of history within a film became kind of a centerpiece of the book in some ways. And the purpose of the chapter was really to look in a lot of detail at what Hilberg was doing across his writings from the initial canonical work, The Destruction of the European Jews, and how that it, remarkably consistent, actually, his judgments were fairly consistent across, but obviously changed in the detail and so on at times, through to his different book, which in a sense was a bit of a response to his lack of reliance on survivor testimony in his later book, Perpetrators, Victims, Bystanders. And then he went on to be an editor of sorts on the publication of Adam Shanyakov's diary, the Jewish leader in the Warsaw Ghetto. The Jewish leader you mention, who may well, I'm not sure if it was Hilberg that argued that, or it certainly has been others, may well have been perceived as remembered as a hero, was Chaim Rumkowski of the Lodz Ghetto. Given that the Russian army had stopped at that point, that was very pivotal to the fate of Jews in that ghetto. And so that was kind of a really interesting moment where history can turn on a dime in a sense, but Rumkowski is certainly a very, very heavily criticized, is probably putting it mildly, figure. But even there, Levy saw some ambiguity, and Hilberg talks about him to some degree in Perpetrators, Victims, Bystanders, which is sort of a tripartite study of those categories. He does give some attention to Jewish leaders within that book, but doesn't specifically focus on them. But what I tried to do in this chapter, and I'll take it as a compliment, is if it seemed like I was trying to understand how we should understand and judge these Jewish leaders, because even here, when I'm only trying to unpack what Hilberg was doing in his own work, I can't avoid describing, analyzing, and putting forward an almost oppositional view to what Hilberg was the vast majority of the time, and in the process criticizing Hilberg's representation when I'm writing about these figures. So the fact that I'm writing about Jewish leaders here, in terms of your question, do we judge by their actions or intentions, that presupposes, I guess, that we can get a very clear-cut understanding of their intentions, because as I think Levy highlighted, even in the case of Rumkowski, the intentions were very murky at times. There was always there's never a monodimensional kind of answer that we can look to, and the motivations and the pressures, external forces that were really pushing Jewish leaders from all directions and from both directions, from, I guess, below and above, for lack of a better metaphor, were really intense. So I guess I just fell back on Levy's assertion, or his argument that we cannot pass judgment even on Chaim Rumkowski, even though he did pass judgment on him through the language and the metaphors he used himself. So looking at that, I tried to distill what Hilberg was doing, the rhetorical devices he was using, his very controversial, I'd say problematic use of visualization, sort of almost a kind of a diagram that had no reference but his own judgment, the one of the things that I look at one point. Even Hilberg started to kind of, from his writing at least, started to develop an empathetic perspective, or at least a more sympathetic perspective, for the position of Jewish leaders. And I think that's in large part because of his engagement with Adam Shanyakov's diary, which then was the reason he became such a forceful figure within Landsman Shoah. And that sort of created a nice little connection between historical writing and the role of the historian and history, and moving on to kind of, you know, documentary representation through documentary film. That's probably not getting at your question completely, but I sort of trying to sidestep that question of how do we judge Jewish leaders, because I quite often gave presentations, and at the end of a presentation, I specifically remember at the University of Melbourne, I talked only about Raoul Hilberg's work, and I did this at a few conferences, and at the very end, even after I'd argued that we cannot pass judgment on Rumkowski, I had a whole conference paper on Rumkowski once, and this is what the survivor memoirs, and this is what Hilberg has done, and so on. and I talked about Levy and different survivors, how they judged Brumkovsky. Even then, I still remember the first question I got from someone who'd spent their life teaching and studying the Holocaust was, so what do you think of Brumkovsky? How are we going to judge him? And so I've never escaped that. And you can't escape it, but you can only keep reflexively thinking about this problem of and it's an impossible problem because it's almost a sin to put yourself into that situation, and given you can never really empathize as well. But that draws together again that question, and what would you have done? Again, that I'll probably come back to.
And so, I think that this is something that, in general, your book, it's kind of an invitation that I took from reading your book, is that it's not so much about only the judgment, but it's maybe more important to take it to the next stage and what we can learn from that about human dignity, right? I mean, the question of what we should do next with that. It's not what only I would do if I was at the Holocaust, but also the question of what I'm doing today. What are the actions that we are taking, and what are the actions that we choose not to take? And I think this is something that we can learn a lot from, or the questions that are there from the materials that you bring, we can take it to our life. And since we come to the last part, I want to shift to the last chapters of your book, which focus on cinema. And my interest is if we can go to the more modern, in the past 20 years, we have some incredible movies that touch the place of the privileges. I think, personally, I think about The Gray Zone from 2001 that you work a lot in your book about. And also in 2015, there is a Hungarian movie, The Son of Saul. And since movies and Netflix and Amazon Prime, like the media of an Eve story that we just had in the a year ago, right, with the Instagram as so it's becoming such an important place where the young generation, we are learning and we are thinking and feeling about what the Holocaust is. So I wonder if you can help us to understand more about what we can learn about privileges from this media, and what maybe are going to be, I wonder about the future movies that are going to come, and the role that, or how we should speak or feel or create the image of the privileges.
Yeah, I think that I'd like to go back to a quotation that probably the most used in all the things that I've published on the Gray Zone by me. Levy wrote, and he actually wrote this at different times, and he slightly reworded it for the essay on the Gray Zone. He wrote in that essay, "From many signs, it would seem the time has come to explore the space which separates the victims from their persecutors, and to do so with a lighter hand and with a less turbid spirit than has been done, for instance, in a number of films." That, for me, is kind of a nicely ironic moment and segue onto looking at cinema, because it was, as I said earlier, it was the reason why the primary reason why I discovered this subject, dedicated a great deal of my work to the Holocaust, and came to be in this sort of this area at all, given it was a film. And the interesting thing was, this film, The Gray Zone by Tim Blake Nelson, which I wrote on in the last chapter of the book and contrasted that with Spielberg's Schindler's List, this film, The Gray Zone, was one of the first, if not the first, films that I would say formed part of what I would call elsewhere a third wave of Holocaust cinema. It's comes from the idea Annette Insdorf had of two different waves. She talked about the first as focusing on victims and persecutors, sort of setting down the stories, the factual details of what happened. And then the second wave was on rescue and resistance. And that brought in Schindler's List and a great deal more, you know, untold number of other films that focused on happy endings and heroic deeds in particular. And I started to think about what happened with The Grey Zone and beyond, even though those relatively more optimistic stories of heroism and sacrifice would continue, a third wave of Holocaust films that focused on trauma, guilt, and compromise. And that's not specifically about so-called privileged Jews, but it did incorporate that. And there was an amazing insight, which turned out to be very true, and one of the people I was reading that said, you know, The Grey Zone, this kind of theme, this taboo issue will be explored in the coming years. And that's exactly what happened. A year later, Joseph Sargent had a made-for-television movie on Gisela Pearl called Out of the Ashes, not quite as nuanced and complex as The Grey Zone, but still engaging directly with that ethical dilemmas of privileged Jews. You also had the German film Ghetto, based around Jakob Gens' experiences. It was an adaptation of a really famous play, or one of a trilogy of plays, an amazing film that looks at Jakob Gens in a really intricate and compelling way. In a sense, that, and I'd say even the Austrian film The Counterfeiters, is probably just as impressive a representation of so-called privilege within camps and ghettos as The Grey Zone is of the Zonderkommando. And then you've got Son of Saul, which most recently came out, again looking at the Zonderkommando. And my latest chapter that was published in a book about the Zonderkommando exclusively, which only published last year, looks at both The Grey Zone and Son of Saul. And I felt that was kind of a bookend to my research in this area. Who knows, I may come back to it. But that film as well raised lots of new questions about representations, or perhaps reinvigorated old questions. Looking but not looking at the Zonderkommando, the privileged prisoners, as privileged. So there's different ways you can read that, and I you know, would probably read it again differently if I watched the film, just as I would The Grey Zone today. So all of these films have come out over the last 20 years, as you say, and I think there is very much an interest on the part of audiences, and therefore, or alongside that, an interest on the part of filmmakers to explore these often tabooed, previously marginalized issues of so-called complicity or compromise, whatever words we want to use for it. The more words I use, privilege probably starts to sound relatively banal. But these issues have been explored in much more complex and intricate and nuanced ways through these feature films in particular fiction films, than elsewhere. There are a number of documentaries that, to varying degrees of effectiveness, I would argue, do engage with the issue of privilege. But, you know, these issues can be quite often, and this is what I found in my analysis of The Grey Zone, a non-literal depiction of events. The Nelson's narrative choices that moved away from the chronological facts, which merged different phenomena from very different time periods, which merged events, which moved away from who survived. You know, he actually had some pressure, I believe, to focus on Miklos Nishli, who survived, and make the film about him, but he didn't want to make it just another survivor story, to focus on those who didn't survive. Which again kind of, you know, complicates Levy's distinction between the drowned and the saved, given that so many Zonderkommando, which he would certainly have classified as damned, to use his words, did not survive, bar a very small number. So all of these kinds of things have been explored in really compelling, affective, but I think also different ways that help us not fully understand, will never understand, but do raise that question, which I end the book with, and what would you have done? Because that's really the central question that comes out of the gray zone, even though you can interpret there is some judgment of certain victims in more negative ways than other victims, certainly more sympathetic of the crematorium workers in the gray zone than the prisoner Dr. Miklos Nishli. And he's also in Son of Sol in a very, you know, very brief but somewhat different portrayal in that movie. So even the scenes that were left out of that film, there's so many interesting things, all the little decisions, the techniques, the devices that filmmakers, just as historians and just as survivors who are, you know, very literary or not so literary in their writings, they all use conventions. They rely on this paucity of language, but also the power of language, because that's all we've got in the end. And the visual does add a certain element. I would argue, and this is what I do in the book, probably more implicitly in my less confident days, that feature films, particularly fictional representations, have a certain power to explore these issues of moral ambiguity and compromise because they can immerse us in those very issues. I shouldn't make a value judgment, and I tried not to in the book to say that it's better than reading history, it's better than reading survivor literature or anything like that. That's certainly not what I mean by that, but there is a certain possibility that's to be found in Holocaust film that Levy himself probably understandably didn't get to experience. I can completely understand why Levy would be skeptical, especially as a survivor, of what Hollywood and other film industries were doing at the time with the Holocaust. But even there, some of the films that he had seen, I've written recently about privileged Jews in the Holocaust miniseries, which was 1978, I believe. There is actually some nuance and interesting ethical dilemmas represented, albeit briefly, in that very soap opera-ish Hollywood production. So there's been a lot of remarkable things. And I guess the one thing that I started to almost worry about with the latest collection that's exclusively focused on Zonderkommandos, and there has been a number of films that have directly focused on them to some degree, or they've become, you know, they certainly have been a part of a plot and often serve plot elements, which I go into in the book, which are political or religious in terms of the Christianization of the Holocaust in some films. That issue of the Zonderkommandos are very, for lack of a better word, appealing as a category of the most extreme of experiences we can think of. My concern that I did briefly bring up in my latest chapter, and I'm complicit in this given that my book was one of the first to focus on this issue in this way, my concern is that now, are we focusing too much? Are the Zonderkommandos, the crematorium workers, getting, as some argued even before the Grey Zone film came out, too much attention at the expense of the less exceptional experience? And what does that mean? So, you know, there's never any ideal, but I think that there are potentially risks that go into focusing on issues of privilege, especially depending on the reason why it's being used. And I'm not making a really clear statement there, but that's sort of something that's raised in my mind, that this is one aspect of a very huge event that has various facets. So I don't want to say this is the, as I probably made the mistake of implying in the book, that this is the essence or a crux of the Holocaust that we need to understand as its core. A lot of people have talked about this is the center of the ethical dilemmas of the Holocaust and so on. In some ways that's true, but I don't want to suggest that this is the most important aspect of the Holocaust either, because that's probably a small risk that's being run now, depending on one's perspective and engagement with all the attention that this is getting. I also went on during and beyond this, the writing of this book, to analyze so-called privileged use in video testimony and so on. And I think going to another aspect of your question, where do we go from here? I do not know what Holocaust films will be. I've got probably the country's most depressing DVD collection, and I'll never get to watch them all. But there's so many that still come out. I think what's really interesting to me now, given that I'm no longer a student of history and literature, and I've now, I guess, for lack of a better word, transformed myself into a lecturer in digital media, and the Holocaust is only one aspect of my research, and very rarely do I teach any aspects of it apart from very briefly. I'm also very interested in what engagement and what representation means in a digital age, as you say, when the Holocaust survivors, the absolute crucial core of the power of so many museums around the world, including the one that I've worked with, are slowly not, or gradually no longer with us. If anything, all of the challenges that the memory and representation of the Holocaust has faced, that is the greatest one. So now that I'm working in the digital space, to sort of segue on to something beyond this book, but something I've pointed to in recent chapters on film that now I think is something to look at, is what is digital, what does a digital immersive experience of Holocaust representation entail? What do we talk about? What do we think about the potential to create a gamified representation of the Holocaust, which doesn't necessarily mean a game, but there have been video and board game attempts already. So I think that what we're seeing in the world outside the Holocaust and its representation is that involving audiences in order to engage them in a participatory way, in a way that gives them agency, in a way that actually allows them choice of how to choose the between narrative options, or to discover history in different ways and other forms of education. My big interest in social media, digital learning and gamification may well intersect with the Holocaust in that way. Maybe it will intersect with the representation of privileged Jews, but that's where we are now. I think that you have to keep making Holocaust films, because so few people now have ever seen Schindler's List, and I'd be very hard-pressed to find any of my students who've seen The Grey Zone or Schindler's List. So that's sort of the next adventure, for lack of a better word, that I may well be situating myself on. But hopefully that answers some of your question.
Yes, for sure. We need to end, but I'm thinking about one of the educators, the Jewish educators today, Avraham Infeld. He has a sentence that he loved to say, that Jews don't have history, Jews have memory. In the Passover night, Jews, we don't tell exactly what happened in Egypt, but what we tell is how Jews during the generations, they remember what happened in Egypt, in the Passover Haggadah. And it's such an existential Jewish question, right? That we try to make it alive. We try to take the history and to live it again and again. In each generation, the people need to feel as if they themselves came out from Egypt. And I think that what you touch here at the last sentences, and the media and the digital media, is exactly how to maybe hold both of them, like to hold the history, but also to make people to connect to the history by creating it as a life memory. And I want to end, if it's okay, with, I think, one of the quotations that you bring in your book from The Grey Zone. In the Jewish theology, there is, and in the morning prayer, there is a beautiful prayer that speaks about the responsibility of community. And the words there are that the community needs to honoring the parents and providing hospitality and visiting the sick. But then there is a sentence which says, and they need to lelavot et hamet, which means, the translation is attending to the dead, taking care on the dead of the community. But actually in Hebrew, the word lelavot, which is funeral in Hebrew, the verb funeral, is to walk with, is to accompany the dead. In a way, it's like happening before they died and not after. And I want to end it with such a powerful, powerful quotation in page 176 from The Gray Zone. Rosenthal and Abramovich, two people from two Jews who are at the Sonderkommando. And Rosenthal says, it's not pulling the trigger. And Abramovich says, it's locking them in. You leave the room, bring them in, say it's safe. You will see them when it's over. Who put her inside? Now you think she made it through. God knows how. You're doing to be a hero? And Rosenthal said, not a hero. Abramovich, not a hero, not a killer. What are you, Max? Thank you so much, Adam Brown.
Thank you for having me.